Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Kuf Lamed Gimel Amud Bet, five lines from the bottom. Tan Rabbanan, Maseh Be'Adam Echad, Shelo Ayu Banav Noagim Kishura. It was an individual whose children weren't exactly doing what he had expected. They weren't acting appropriately. Amad V'Katav Nechasav LeYonatan Ben Uziel. So he went ahead and he gave all of his possessions to Yonatan Ben Uziel. Yonatan ben Uziel, we'll discuss in a little bit on today's daf, a little bit more about him. He was a Talmud of Hillel HaZaken. He is famous for his Targum that is written on Tanakh. His Targum is more extensive than the Targum Onkelos. As a general issue, whenever you translate something, there are different ways to translate. One way to translate is to use an exact translation of the words. The other way to translate something is to give a to translate in a way that gives the gist of the meaning of what is being said, not to translate word for word, but rather to translate the meaning of that is there. In addition, does the translation simply translate, or does it give perspective and perush to it? And that Unkelus already does some of that. Yonatan ben Uziel does it much more extensively, in including generally the Midrashei Chazal inside of the Targum. And everywhere he's translating, he's not only translating, but he's translating with a peirush, in a sense, with the perspective of Chazal. That's Yonatan ben Uziel. So this individual who was upset at his children decided to disinherit them by giving all of his possessions to Yonatan ben Uziel. What exactly the circumstances that surround the situation are will depend on how you look at this Gemara. This piece of the Gemara is situated between two cases. The cases that we spoke about yesterday, the cases where Yosef ben Yoezer disinherited his son, b'makdish, the money because he felt he wasn't acting appropriately, versus the end of this story, which we'll speak about a Gemara in Nidarim. So if you connect it to the Gemara before, which is what the Rashbam does, then the situation is identical. Here you have an individual whose children are not acting appropriately. So he disinherits them and gives the money to Yonatan ben Uziel, similar to the case before where Yosef ben Uezer disinherited his son for that problematic behavior. On the other hand, if you connect it to the subsequent Gemara, which is really part and parcel of this Gemara, then the case is a case in Beit Choron, which we'll see in a second from the Gemara Nidarim, then the situation would be similar. And the Tosafot quotes such a view from the Rosh Mishantz. He says, in the Rashba, Da'u Gava, Dichtav Nichasav Yonatan Ben Uziel, Hidir Nichasav Mi Bino Bechayav U'Memoto. He took a neder in his lifetime that he would not allow his child to get any benefit from him, both during his lifetime and after his death. So he basically took a neder hana'ah that prevented his child from getting any benefit from his assets. And that's why he gave them to Yonatan ben Uziel, because his child couldn't get the assets. And maybe, and that's what we'll see in a second, maybe he was doing that to circumvent the problem of the neder. He gave it to Yonatan ben Uziel, and that way he could, in a sense, money launder. He could move the money through the Yonatan ben Uziel and then to his son, without it being a problem of the neder, because now it went through a third party. So that could be the case, depending on whether you connect it to the story before or the story afterwards. That will determine what you think the problem he was trying to solve is, or why he gave these possessions to Yonatan ben Uziel. Machar Shlish. So Yonatan ben Uziel took the possessions. He sold off a third. Vehigdish Shlish. It was Magdish, one third of the possessions. Vehzir Banav Shlish. And then he gave back to the children of this bequeather, he gave back one third of the possessions back to them. So he sold a third, which sufficed for him, meaning that supported him. He had enough money then to support himself. It was Makdish Shlish. He gave it to Tzedakah, in a sense that he did something good with this windfall that came to him. And the last third he gave back to the children. Balav Shammai b'maklo v'tarmilo. So Shammai came running over to him with his stick and with his pouch, but he was ready for a fight with Yonatan ben Uziel. He wanted to take issue with what he had done. Amalei. So Yonatan ben Uziel says to Shammai, Shammai, Iata yochol lotzi et mashe mecharti umashe gdashti, if you can go get back what I sold, and you can go get back what I was magdish, ata yochol lotzi mashe chzarti, then you can go and make a claim against the children or what I gave to the children. V'im lav, if you don't have the ability to extract what I sold and what I was makdish, yata yechol otzi ma shechzarti. And then you have no right to go back and reverse what I did by giving it to the children. So now, the question is, what was Shammai thinking in terms of his questioning of what Yonatan ben Uziel did? And then, what was the answer of Yonatan ben Uziel? The Gemara is going to ask the question, and then based on that, we'll come back, circle back, and understand what was going on between them. Amar, hitiach alai ben Uziel, hitiach alai ben Uziel. Hitiach alai is a strong language. It's usually a dismissal, or even an arrogant approach to someone who is of a higher standing than you. In the Gemara Tanit, it's used to describe a behavior of Levi, where he was hitiach dvarim klapei malo, that he spoke inappropriately towards Shemayim, meaning that he said something that was inappropriate vis-a-vis a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So that's what it means, hitiach alai, or hitiach dvarim klapei malo. He said he threw out something, but he said something that was shocking in terms of its relationship to the party that was being said. So also over here, hitiach alai ben Uziel means that Yonatan ben Uziel really stepped up, and his Rebbe, we're going to see in a second, is Hillel. So Shammai is not necessarily a peer of his. Shammai is of a standing of order of his Rebbe and not of him. But nevertheless, he was not shy in his response to Shammai. And Shammai says about that, hitiach alai ben Uziel, you came with a strong stand, but he is right. And here, Shammai admits to the fact that Yonatan ben Uziel was correct. The way the Rashbam formulates it is that he did it bebedichuta. He did it as a joke or not seriously. He wasn't condemning Yonatan ben Uziel for the fact that he spoke in this manner. He was saying that he won the battle. He won the argument. He was right. He threw these things out. He spoke strongly, but he was right about it. And that's what he's saying over here. So now the Gemara asks the question that we had, which was, Mi'ikara, my savar. What was Shammai so upset about that he came reining over to Yonatan ben Uziel and said, what are you doing? Mishumai said the Beit Choron. It's because of the issue of the Mishnah Nidarim that describes this incident in Beit Choron. Titnan, Maseh beBeit Choron, Be'echad, She'ya Aviv Mudar Hem Menu Hana'a. There was this situation in Beit Choron where a person had taken a neder to block his father from getting any benefit from him. Again, this goes back to what we discussed many times in Nidarim, that the usage of Nidarim in their day was many times in a vindictive manner. It was a way to deal with Ben Adam Lechaveiro in a negative light, which is that they used it in order to get revenge, they used it in order to prove a point, or to distance themselves from other parties. It was used in them as a mechanism to, in many senses, destroy the good feelings or the proper behavior of Ben Adam Lechaveiro. And as I spoke about over there, that's maybe why the idea of Hatarat Nidarim and Kol Nidrei is how we begin Yom HaKippurim, because of the way that Nidarim were used in their day. And here's an example of that, which is that the son took a neder where he restricted his father from getting hanah from him. But he was marrying off his child, and he wanted his father to attend the wedding. This is usually the problem with Nidarim, is that people do them in the moment or in the impulsive nature of them. Then later on, they regret them because of the implications are far-reaching. So here is a case where whatever altercation happened between the son and the son blocked the father out from getting any hanah from him. But now the son is marrying off his son, the grandchild, and he wants the grandfather to be there, but he can't be there because if he makes a wedding, the father can't get benefit from that wedding. So what did he do? B'mar l'chaveiro. So he got a third party involved. Harei chatzer v'suda netunin lecha kematana. I'm giving you the courtyard. I'm giving you all the food, all the preparations for the wedding as a gift. V'enan lefanecha el k'dei she'yavo abba v'yochal imanu b'suda. And I'm doing this to facilitate the ability of my father to come and join us for the wedding. So you're going to be the mechanism by which I can circumvent the neder, and thereby my father can come, because it's your suda, and you're making the wedding, and you're making the simcha, and thereby my father's not restricted from coming. Amarlo, so this third party said to him, Im shelihein, if they belong to me, if you just gifted them to me, harien muktashim lashamayim, I sanctify them to Hashemayim, I give them to Hekdesh. Amarlo, lo natati lechad sheli, shiktisham lashamayim, I didn't give you the gift in order to be makdish them. I told you what my intentions were. My intentions were I gave it to you in order to circumvent the neder. So this third party says back to this son, Amar lo, lo natata li et shelcha. The only reason you gave me this property, meaning the sudat, the nisuin, and the chatzer, elishatei atav avicha ochlim v'shotim umratzim ze lezeh. In order that you, your father, can eat and drink and be married together and make up for all that lost time that you had because of these neder. Ve'avon taloi berosho. And then the avon, the sin will be on me. Because now you'll really be in violation of the neder. Lo yechel devaro. One may not profane that which they said. And in this way, you're violating the neder because you didn't really give it to me. You only gave it to me to circumvent the neder, which doesn't work. And then I'm going to become a Masayeya Ovrei Avera. I don't want any part in this. And that's why I said I want to be Makdishit to demonstrate that you didn't really give it to me. You only gave it to me to circumvent the nether. And if that's what you did, then you didn't do it. It didn't work. You can't just give something to circumvent the nether. Amru Chachamim. Chachamim say about this, Kol Matana, Sheina, Sheim Hikdisha, Mekudeshet, Einu Matana. If you have any gift that you can't have enough control or sufficient control that you can be Makdishit, then it's not a gift. And that's what he's saying to him. Listen, you're not allowing me to be makdish. It means that you didn't really give it to me. If you didn't really give it to me, then you didn't circumvent the neder. And that means that you're really violating the neder, and I'm a party to that. And I don't want to be a party to that. So that's the story of Beit Choron. So now going back to our situation over here, the question about what the incident was. Again, according to the Rashbam, it's connected to the previous case, which is they just weren't acting appropriately. So the father disinherited them and gave all the possessions to Yonatan ben Uziel. The other hand, the Balei Tosafot bring from the Rosh Mishnas that the case is connected to Beit Choron. They were doing the same thing. The father had taken a neder anah not to allow his children to benefit from him. So he gave all of his possessions to Yonatan ben Uziel. Now it's easy to understand what the mistake was in what Shammai thought. Yonatan ben Uziel ends up giving the property to the children. So what he's doing is similar to what happened in Beit Choron. He's circumventing the neder. There, he did it, tried to make the wedding so his father could attend. So he gave the property to a third party. But Yonatan ben Uziel, a similar thing is happening. He took this neder ana'ah and wasn't going to give it to his children. He gifts it to Yonatan ben Uziel, and then Yonatan ben Uziel gives it to the children. So that's the problem. It looks like he's using this as haramah to circumvent the problem of the neder. That's why Shammai is so angry and comes running after him, because he thinks it's similar to the case of Beit Choron. The answer that Yonatan ben Uziel says to him is it's totally different. Over here, he did not demand that I give it back to the children. He didn't even specify what he wanted me to do with the property. And I can show you that and demonstrate that because I sold a third of it. I was makdish a third of it. And then I gave the third back. That was my own volition. So that's what Yonatan ben Uziel says. I demonstrated ownership through the sale, through the hekdesh. And therefore, I have a choice. If I want to give it back to the children, it's of my own volition. It's not because of his demand. It's not harama. So there are two differences there. One difference is the fact that by Beit Choron, he gave all of his possessions. He gave the whole amount to him. And he demanded the whole amount be used for the wedding. Over here, Yonatan ben Uziel does not give the whole amount back to the children. Number two is, with the residual, he did something or took actions that demonstrated ownership, which is that he sold it and he was makdishit. And just like the father over here in our case did not tell him to sell it, didn't tell him to be makdishit, or didn't object to him selling it, and didn't object to him being makdishit, that means that the final third that he gave to the children also is not because the father demanded it, or was a part and parcel of the gift. That's the way you would explain it according to the Rosh Mishnas, based on the continuation of the Gemara. For the Rashbam, who believes that this is really connected to the previous Gemara, that the fact that he disinherited them because of their behavior, then what was the mistake that Shammai made? And then what was the answer that Yonatan ben Uziel gave him? So the Rashbam says the mistake that was made was that Shammai compared this case to the case of Beit Choron, which is in Beit Choron, we have an individual who, through his actions, implies that he wants it to be used for the wedding. And so what Shammai says to him, it's clear here that the father gave you the possessions in order that they don't go to the children. The reason he gave you the possessions is to disinherit them. When you go ahead then and give it back to the children, you are violating the terms of the gift that was given to you. You were granted a gift because he wanted to disinherit his children. You give it back to his children, you in a sense violated the whole intent of the gift. Just like by Beit Choron, where the individual says, I'm going to be makdish it. The guy says, then I'm not gifting it to you, because I only gifted it to you in order to make the wedding and to avoid the problem of the neder, basically. But I didn't gift it to you to be makdish it. If you go be makdish it, the gift is withdrawn. So that's what Shammai thought, that the two cases are comparable. In this case, he disinherited his children. Over there, he's trying to avoid the neder. And in both cases, if you don't abide by the intentions of the giver, it falls apart. So that's what Shammai thought. Yonatan ben Uziel's answer to him is, the cases are completely different. Over there in Beit Choron, in the Mishnah Nedarim, he explicitly, when he gives the gift, articulates why he's giving the gift. I'm giving this to you in order that you can make the wedding so I can circumvent the neder. He specifies why he's giving the gift. Over here, he gave it to Yonatan ben Uziel without any specification. It's what we call umdan didat. It is an assumption about what happened. Umdan didat is that you can assume why did he give his possessions to Yonatan ben Uziel? It's because he wanted to disinherit his children. So what Yonatan ben Uziel answers him is that's exactly the difference over here. When he articulates the reason for the gift, you can't just walk away and say, I'll do whatever I want. Because then you're violating the terms of the gift, and it unwinds the gift. But that was his point over there in Beit Choron. He wanted to show that it wasn't really a gift, and it was just an avoidance mechanism. But over here, Yonatan ben Uziel says, he didn't specify. If he doesn't specify, then you can't just assume what his intent was. And therefore the Rashbam says that Yonatan ben Uziel intentionally sold it, was makdish it, to demonstrate the fact that he knew there could be a problem. So he did these other things to show, I can do what I want with it. And since I can do what I want with it, I can also give it back to the kids, and the father has no say in that matter, because he gifted them entirely to me. So that's the way the Rashbam learns it. All right, so that's the nature of the two ways to read the Gemara, depending if you connect it to the piece before or connect to it afterwards, whether the problem was whether he was violating the intent of the gift, that's the way the Rashbam views it, or according to the Rosh Mishantz, it was that he was trying to do haroma to circumvent the neder, and how that's different in each of these cases from the case of Beit Choron. Again, for the Rashbam, the difference is there was articulated the intent. Over here, the intent was only implicit, and therefore it's not governing. For the Rosh Mishantz, the difference is over there, it was haroma because the only way he gave the gift was to do the wedding, not anything else. Over here, it wasn't haroma because he did it of his own volition. He gave back to the kids, but he demonstrated ownership through the hekdesh and through the selling. Now, the last piece here in the Gemara is very problematic, which is that the Gemara says, the only time you own something is if you can be makdishit. The problem that Tosafot raises here, Tosafot in the Gemara in Sukkah also raises it, because of a Gemara further on here in Baba Batra, is the same Gemara appears in Sukkah as well, which is the concept of matana amanat achzir. Someone gifts something with the tanai, the condition that you return it. So there the Gemara says that's sufficient of a gift that you can be yotze the mitzvah of lulav and etrog. There's a requirement that lulav and etrog belong to you on the first day. Lakaktam lachem, it has to be shelachem, you have to own it. So that means that on the first day of Sukkot, unless you own your lulav and etrog, you're not yotze the mitzvah. We have other mitzvot like that, but generally it's not a problem. By lulav etrog, it's a more serious issue. And therefore, if you give it to someone, you can give it to them with the assumption or the condition that they will give it back to you. And in that short period of time where they have it, it's sufficient ownership to them to be yotze the mitzvah. What Tosafot raises here, and the Gemara in Sukkah as well, is how could that be? We said that the test of ownership is that whether you can be makdishit. Over there, you can't be makdishit because you have to give it back. If you don't give it back, you don't get ownership. The condition of ownership is that you give it back. If you can't give it back, then you're not owning it. So if you're makdishit, then the whole gift fails, and you can't be makdishit because you didn't really get it as a gift. Right? That whole circle goes around and around, and you won't have the ownership. So how could it work? How could it be that you have enough ownership to do the mitzvah lulav if you can't be makdish the item? So Tosfot asks the question in both cases, and he gives two answers. The first answer is, you can be makdishit. You can be makdishit for the period of time that you own it. The Matana Makdazir gives you a period of time in which you own it, and during that period of time, you could be Makdishit. Tosafot even suggests here that it would automatically terminate the Hekdesh. During the period of time you own it, it'll be Hekdesh. As soon as your period when you have to give it back comes about, it'll go back to him without any questions. The Hekdesh is over and it goes back. There are others who want to suggest that you'd have to be Podet. You'd have to redeem it. I mean, you could be Makdish, Dadim, Hekdesh, and then you'll have to redeem it to give it back to him in order to fulfill the Neder. But that's one way Tosfot answers, which is to say, in Ochanami, you can be Makdish it. The second answer of Tosfot is much more important. It's the way that most of the Rishonim view it, because it has more serious implications with regards to Matanah Manat Gzir, which is that he says that Hekdesh is a siman and not a siba. It's not a demonstration of ownership to be able to makdish an item. If you can't be makdish it, you don't own it. Hekdesh is a way to demonstrate control. It's a way to demonstrate ownership. It's a test. There are other ways to demonstrate ownership, or there are other ways to check for ownership. This is just a test. It's a litmus test to check whether you really do own it or don't own it. But just because you can't be makdish it doesn't mean that you don't own it. There are other ways to demonstrate control or ownership. And what he says is, over here, the reason that Chazal used Hekdesh over here was because the nature of the gift was questionable. It was haroma. The whole point of this gift over here was to circumvent the nether. So it was a weak gift to start with. So how do I check whether it's a good gift or a weak gift? I go and test whether you can be Makdishit. So that's a way to demonstrate control when you have a weak type of gift. The way that Yerushalmi phrases it, that's the way Tosafot brings over here is, Kol matana shehi kimasei beit choron. Any type of gift that involves this circumvention is a weak type of gift, and it's not a real gift. And how do I test that? I can show you that it's a weak gift because you can't be makdish it. But it doesn't mean that being makdish is the sole test for control or ownership. It's just when you have a weak type of gift or something that looks like a circumvention of halacha, use hekdesh to test whether it really is or isn't. But in the case of Matanah Manat Gzir, where you give the etrog to someone to use, or the lulav and the etrog to use, over there, you're definitely giving them full control during that period of time. It's not a haroma. It's a gift that says, during this period of time, you have full control over it. It's yours during that period of time. Just the one condition is that you have to return it to me. So then, the question of why that works, or how that works, we'll leave for Kuf Lamed Zayin. But whether you have to articulate it explicitly that you want to give it to him, but he has to return it, that's a condition of the borrowing. It's not really borrowing, it's really a gift because he has full ownership during that period of time. Or is it implicit? Tosafot in Sukkah speaks about a problem that should be apparent, that many European countries, especially when they lived in places where it's very hard to get lulav and etrog, we live in countries now, especially in Eretz Yisrael, where it's easy to get a hold of lulav and etrog. They're in climates where they grow. And whether that's here, or whether that's maybe even the United States, where they have a West Coast, where they can grow these things, so there's easily attainable. But in case of places like Europe, a palm tree or a palm branch and etrogim were very hard to get a hold of. Tosafot speaks about the issue of they used to bequeath them to their children. They used to pass lulavim from year to year. And therefore Tosafot speaks about a lulav, a yavesh, can't simply mean a dried out lulav. It has to be a lulav that falls apart, that crumbles, because it's so old or dried out. Because otherwise, how are we passing lulavim from generation to generation? He also speaks about the fact that they used to require a single lulav and etrog for the entire community. And there are many tshuvot written about this, but Tosafot says, how does it work? Not everybody in the community knows that when you pick up the lulav and etrog, that you're doing it on a matanah manat gzir. You have to take it, you get possession for them, and then you have to give it back to the community or to other parties that are there. People don't all know the halacha, so they're picking up the lulav and etrog without any of these intents. So Tosafot over there says in Sukkah that there's an implicit intent. Because the only way he can be yotzei the mitzvah is if he does it matanah manat gzir. And since his intent is to do the mitzvah, we assume that he does the mitzvah correctly, and therefore we imply the intent that he must know that it's a matanah manat gzir, and we assume that's what he does here. Even though he doesn't understand the halacha, even though he doesn't know that, but the only way for him to be yotzei is to have it be a matanah manat gzir. So we assume that's what he did, or we imply those intentions to him, because of the fact that's the only way you can be yotzei. So Tosafot says that matanah manat gzir can even work without an articulation of it. Even just through implications of that's the only way it's going to work. So that you have that problem. Many times people want to borrow your lulav and etrog. So when you give it to them, you have to explain to them it's a matanah manat gzir. Some people don't understand that. Some people don't know. But that's your intent when you give it. That might be enough to make it a matanah manat gzir. That the person has to return it and abide by the conditions that you would have assumed in order that they could use it in order to be yotzei the mitzvah lulav ben etrog. So Tan Rabbanan, so here's some background to Yonatan ben Uziel. 80 talmidim ayu lo Hillel HaZakein. There were 80 students that Hillel HaZakein had. This is Hillel and Shammai, peers. 30 mehem ruim shitishrei aleihem shechina kemoshe Rabbeinu. 30 of them were of the level we're worthy of having the Shekhinah, the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, be with them like it was with Moshe Rabbeinu, which means to speak to them either panim el panim, or to have direct nevuah, not through a chalom. They were of a significant level, as the Rashbam says over here, but the door was not ra'ui. The generation wasn't, the right generation wasn't appropriate for it. So they attained that level, but it didn't happen because of the fact that the generation wasn't worthy of them having that. The Marshal of Eir mentions that the Gemara in Sanhedrin says about Hillel HaZakein, Shigil Lamala Rabbam, that these individuals, these students reached the status or state of their Rebbe. Da'achi Amrina Beber Kamed Sanhedrin Behillel HaZakein, in the first parak in Sanhedrin it says about Hillel, Ro'oi Ayash Tishrei Alav Shekhinah Kemoshe Rabbeinu, that he was worthy of having the Shekhinah appear to him like Moshe Rabbeinu. So what it's saying over here, according to the Marsha, is 30 of his students reached the level of their Rebbe of Hillel HaZakein. Why was Hillel Zuchet to that level? It's because he was known as a great Anav. And we know that's the unique quality of Moshe Rabbeinu, that he was Anav, Mikol Adam. He was the most humble or had the greatest humility of any other person. And Hillel HaZakein demonstrated that same type of character, that same type of midot, and that's why he was like Moshe Rabbeinu, and these Talmidim, again, lived up to their Rebbe's example, and were able to attain that. There were another 30 of them that were like Yoshua ben Nun, and were worthy of the fact that the sun would stop for them, like it stopped for Yoshua ben Nun. As the Rashbam points out here, the sun didn't just stop for Yoshua ben Nun, it also stopped for Moshe Rabbeinu. Based on Chazal, they have a Gzeir Shava that shows that in the battles of Sichon and Og, that Moshe Rabbeinu also did something similar to Yoshua ben Nun. The idea might be either that by Moshe Rabbeinu it wasn't explicit, by Yoshua it's explicit, this is one of the big things that Yoshua ben Nun does. It also might be a hint to what we saw earlier in the Masechta, that Pnei Moshe k'pnei Achama, Pnei Yoshua k'pnei Alivana, that the face of Moshe was like the face of the sun, the face of Yoshua is like the face of the moon. The moon that reflects the light of the sun. So Moshe Rabbeinu was of a certain level. Yoshua's Talmid is one step removed from his Rebbe because he was like Pnei Alevana. And similar over here. So he is like, the 30 students were like Yoshua ben Nun, meaning that they were Talmidim of Hillel HaZakein, but Talmidim like Yoshua ben Nun, which means they didn't attain the level of their Rebbe. But they were of significant individuals. They could stop the sun like Yoshua ben Nun. They reflected the sun of their Rebbe, but they weren't their Rebbe. Then, 20 Benonim. There were 20 middle individuals. So the assumption over here, Benonim, means that they were in between those two sets of 30. There were 30 that attained the level of their Rebbe. There are 30 that were Talmidim. And the Marsha says, 20 Benonim means that there were 20 that were Talmidei Chaverim, to their Rebbe, which is a title where the Talmid reaches up to be on par with his Rebbe, but he doesn't become his Rebbe. So he said just that that's what the Esrim Benonim is. You could technically read Esrim Benonim to mean there were 20 average individuals, which means that that's a set below the first 30, the second 30, and then the 20 were below that, not in between the two sets of 20. Gadol Shebikulan, the greatest of them was Yonatan Ben Uziel. Again, here you can read that in one of two ways. The greatest of the greatest, which means the top 30, he was the top of the top 30, he was the top Talmid of Hillel HaZakein, or you could read it as that he is the top of the middle 20. Benonim, it's modifying that and saying he was the greatest of the middle 20. Katan Shebekulan, and again you could say the same thing over here, the bottom of the Talmidim was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So that could mean that he was the lowest of the low, meaning that he was at the bottom, or it could mean that he was the lowest of the Benonim. So depending on what you think it's qualifying, you would say that about them. Amru alav Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. They said about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, again, who is the bottom of his students. He's the lowest of his students. Shaloi niach. He did not leave anything that was not covered or plowed by him, meaning that he knew everything about Mikra, is Tanakh. Mishnah is the Mishnayot, literally. Gemara, obviously you can't take Gemara literally over here because he precedes what we know as the Gemara today. And therefore the Rashbam explains over here Gemara, which is Svarat HaMishnayot. It is the logic behind the Mishnayot, which is the way that we or our Talmud works. It asks questions about the Mishnayot. It brings stirot between the Mishnayot and brings resolution to those. It's a way to aggregate and to streamline the Mishnayot in a way that makes them all make sense. And so Gemara refers to that type of pilpul or that iyun that comes after you know all the Mishnayot. How do you deal with them as a body of work and reconcile between them? That's what the Gemara is. Or the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom writes it is Talmud, or Gemara is Zo Halacha. That refers to Halacha, which means not only Mishnayot, but Gam Psak Halacha, which is that he also not only had the knowledge, but had the knowledge enough to bring it to a Psak Halacha, Halacha Lemaseh. So you could keep one finger in the Rishbam, one finger in the Rabbeinu Gershom, because we have a series of items over here where the Gemara is going to say that this is what Rabbi Yochanan and Ben Zakkai knew, and then each of them interprets it slightly differently. So then first of all, we had Mikra, Mishnah, Gemara. Now we have Halachot. The way that the Rashbam explains Halachot is Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. On the other hand, the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is Ilu Breitot. This refers to the Breitot, the Sifri, the Sifra, means that it's the Midrash Halacha. That's what it refers to with Halachot. On the other hand, the Rashbam views it as being Halachot L'Moshe Misinai. Next is Agadot. Here everybody agrees. That refers to the Midrashei Agadah, Breshit Rabbah, Vayikra Rabbah, those Midrashim on the Psukim, but Midrashei Agadot. Diktukei Torah. So over here, the Rashbam thinks of Diktukei Torah is Vav Divazeh, or like the Hey Ayidiyah. These are letters or extra letters that we are Doresh throughout the Torah. That's what it means, Diktukei Torah. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom says Diktukei Torah, Gagon chaserot, v'yeterot, u'misorot. It refers to the letters that are missing, or the extra letters in the Torah that are put in, or misorot, anything that has to do with the misorah, of the way that the Torah is written. That's what it references to by diktukei Torah. Diktukei sofrim, the way that the Rashbam reads diktukei sofrim is gagon gzerot, shegazru chachamim. All of the decrees, all of the institutions of the chachamim, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was familiar with them, or understood them, or was able to put in gzeirot in order to protect against Yisurei Doraita. He put in Yisurei Derabanan. The other hand, the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom reads Diktukei Sofrim is Kol Cheshbon Shemanu Chachamim. All these enumerations that the Chachamim have, for instance, the Mishnayot that say Chamesh Yisrei of this, Chamesh of this. It's a numeric system that gives you a numeration of certain items in each section. But it's Diktukei Sofrim. It's a way that the Chachamim gathered the information and consolidated the information until you have five people that can do this. There are five types of this. There's 20 of this. And that these are ways to both to remember it, but also to bound the information in a way that tells you this is what belongs in this place. Then we have V'kalim V'chamorim. That's pretty straightforward. Kal V'chomer, which are logical extensions of what you have learned. That's what somebody can be dan mi'atzmo to learn from that other halachot. Then you have Gzerot Shavot, which again is pretty straightforward. Those things, they have a misora of words that are connected that bring halachot between them. Ut Kufot, the way that the Rashbam writes it over here is Kufot is Molad Alevana, the calculation of the lunar cycle of Rosh Chodesh. Probably it refers to also the solar cycle, because generally Tkufot are used to describe the seasons and to describe the calculate the 19-year cycle to even out between the lunar and the solar cycles, and he understood how all of these things worked. Then the gematriot. So here again, you have a difference between them. Gematriot, according to the Rashbam, is notrikun. It's basically acronyms. That you take words in the Torah, like he gives you an example over here, anochi, and then you break it out that each letter in that word represents another word. Ana, nafshi, tavit, yavit, and then he does the same thing with yarat. So it's basically Roshei Tevot, an acronym that using, that's what he calls Gematriot. On the other hand, the way that I would have explained Gematriot is the simpler way, like for instance, by Nazir. But Nazir, it says, Kadosh Iyeh, Gadol Peri Rosho. So Chazal learned from the word Iyeh, the Gematriot of Iyeh is 30. That tells you that Stam's Nizirut is 30 days. So that would be a Gematriot where it has halachic implications, which is that you use the numeric value of the word to come to a halachic outcome. So that would be the simpler way to read Gematriot, although the Rashbam reads it as being notrikun. Umeshalot kovsim. These are the parables of the launderers. Sorach yesh ba limod divrei Torah, the Rashbam says. You have something to learn from it. So the kovsim, who had a lot of time, laundering took a very long time in their day. It was a heavy duty work. And probably to distract themselves or to be involved in some intellectual pursuit while they're laundering, They used to have these mishalot that they came up with, these parables that they came up with, which were wise and had meaning to them. And so the Rashbam says that those mishalot kubsim were helpful, both in maybe conveying divrei Torah, as well as using them to enlighten certain areas of the Torah. And that's what the pasuk in Qehelet says, tikein mishalim harbei. That Shlomo HaMelech put together mishalim. So a mashal has value, even though it's maybe something that seems mundane, or it's put together by the kubsim, it still has Torah value. And you have to understand them and try to explain them in order to get to the depth of the message that is being conveyed. Then it says, Umishalot shualim, and the mishalot of animals, which the Navi speaks about with regards to Shlomo HaMelech, that he had all these mishalim and mishalim of the animals. And so it's over here, they use the mishalim of the animals, again, to convey ideas or to express certain nuances. They use these mishalim. Sichat shedim. He understood the conversation of the Shedim. The Rashbam writes the reason for that is because Lashbiyam, in order to make sure that they don't misbehave. So if you have to put together a kameya, an amulet, or you have to do something for refuah because of the Shedim, if you understand how they speak and you understand what's going on with them, then you can intervene and protect the individual. So that's why Sichat Shedim is important. The Sichat Dikalim, as well as the conversations of the trees, the Rashbam brings over here because they're Bnei Adam Rigilim to the Berla de Kalim. People sometimes speak about the trees. Like it says, by Shlomo HaMelech, that he spoke about the trees. Now, whether that means knowledge or wisdom about the trees, or the way that Rabbeinu Gershom writes it is, Chosh, he knew how to do lachash in some sort of incantation or something that he would say. That would cause the field to be full of trees. Or do the reverse and have them all be uprooted and come out of the field. I think that the Rabbeinu Gershom is being influenced by the Gemara in Sanhedrin that discusses these types of alternate powers, like lechisha, what they are. And over there it discusses this concept that a person had the ability to make a field be full of something and then remove it. So that's probably what he's leaning on, that Rabbi Yochanan had the ability to do that. So whether that is because he had that power to intercede with the nature, or does it mean that he understood it so that, what Gemara and Sanhedrin says, you need to understand it in order to punish those that are doing it or misbehaving by doing these, whether they're optical illusions or using these dark powers to try to make themselves look like they have superpowers or understanding. Sichat Malachei Asharet. To understand the conversations of the Malachim, over here again, the Rashbam says, Ashbiyam. In order to force them to do things, you can make them take a shvua, whether that's for protection, whether that's for helping out. V'davar gadol, v'davar katan. Everything big and everything small. Gemara says, what's that? Davar gadol, masei merkava. Davar gadol means the masei merkava, which we just read on Shavuot, the Haftorah from Shavuot, the beginning of Yechezkel, which references to the presence of the Shekhinah and the understanding of the presence of the Shekhinah. Gemara in Chagiga speaks about it in terms of its depth and how unique or rare it is that people understand the Maaseh HaMerkava properly. But Devar Katan, Havayot Abai V'Rova, are the questions of Abai and Rova. Again, over here, it doesn't make so much sense because Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai lives many years before Abai and Rova. So you can explain it in different ways. The way that the Rashbam explains it is, Shikshu Mishnayot Ubraito Tuvum V'Tertzum. That they brought all these questions between Mishnayot and Brayotot, and then they answered them. So the idea would be that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was mikaving to those answers. That he had those answers. He was able to reconcile them. Others say it in a more mystical sense, that he was able to get to the Shoresh of what Abai and Rova were going to say, so that he understood that depth, and therefore he was able to answer those questions before they came up, because he understood, or he had that depth of understanding that they had. And others suggest that he was able to reach the understanding that Abai and Rova had after they went through the pilpul, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was able to reach that without all that pilpul of Abai and Rova. This is what is said about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. It's Mikayim the Pasuk, Shenemar L'Anchil Ova Yesh, Ve'otzroteim Amalei. That is to give over, to a bequeath to my beloved Yesh, Ve'otzroteim Amalei, and I will fill their storage, or I will fill their silos. So this actually is the pasuk that's brought to say that every Talmud Chacham has Shai Olamim, has 310 worlds. And so the way that the Rashbam learns it is, the Lanchilo of Ayesh, why are they entitled, or why are they going to get their 310 worlds? Because Otsrutayem Amalei, they filled their silos. So that means it's referencing to the Chachamim. The Chachamim who filled their silos with Torah, like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, they are deserving of the reward of the Shai Olamim. That's one way to read it. Other hand, the Marsha reads it as being that the Otsrutayem Amalei was the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Anchilo Vayesh, my beloved, I will bequeath to them, Ve'otzrotayem Amalei, and I will fill their silos, I will fill their storage, meaning that this is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has all of this, then what is left over for those that are even greater than Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? And that's what the Pasuk answers, is Ve'otzrotayem Amalei. Shem says, I have more and more to fill for those that are of even greater level. Those that reach those greater intellectual heights, or those closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Shem says, I have more and more reward, or I have more to fill them with. The more that you do, the more that I have to give. So that's the neat reason for the pasuk. V'yachar dekatan shebekulam kein, gadol shebekulam achad kama v'kama. This is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who is the lowest on the totem pole, then certainly so, kal v'chomer, to those that were greater than them, you can only imagine what their capacities were, what their powers were, or just get a sense of what Hillel HaZaken, when we speak about him, what type of individual we were speaking about. Amar alav Yonatan ben Uziel, b'shah sheyoshev v'osek b'torah, kol ov shepareach alav nisraf. They said about Yonatan ben Uziel, remember, compared to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Yochanan ben Zakkai was at the bottom, Yonatan ben Uziel was on the top. So then it says about him that when he was sitting and learning Torah, any bird that flew over him was burnt. So the way that they express it is that, in Sukkah, the Tosafot says this, is that he was like his Sinai. Just like at Har Sinai, there was a light and sound show, and there was fire when the Torah was given. So too, when he learned Torah, it was as if it was at Sinai, and there was fire surrounding him, and it burnt out everything that was around him. So that's one way to express it, speaking about the greatness of this individual. The Yerushalmi itself asks, well then, if that was Yonatan ben Uziel, what was the story with Hillel HaZaken? Or if you think Yonatan ben Uziel is only the highest of the middle group, what about all those people above him? So Yerushalmi says that for those that were even greater than him, it just didn't burn up the birds that were right above him. It burned up the birds that were within four amot of him. And it was a bigger perimeter of fire that was around him. So that in a way, it looks at it in a positive light. I want to just add that I once heard, I don't remember where from, and I think that you can prove it from the case in the Gemara in Bamei Madlikin. Gemara Bamei Madlikin speaks about Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and his son Rabbi Elazar that were in the cave. When they emerge from the cave, they come up and they start destroying everything in sight. And Hashem says, back in the cave for another 12 months. When they emerge again, Rabbi Elazar, his son, everywhere he looked, burnt up things. Then when Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai looked at it, he was able to recreate it or to bring it back. So that the son was destructive and the father was constructive. And in that context, what you see is that sometimes people who are young and have those powers, they don't have full control over the powers. And that leads to like the destruction that comes or is borne out by Rabbi Elazar by Rabbi Shimon. And then Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was much more mature and could manage the powers. He was able to be constructive rather than destructive. And you could say the same thing over here. If you read before, like Rabbi Yonatan ben Uziel was the greatest of the middle ones, that's the way that Rabbeinu Gershom reads it, then Rabbi Yonatan ben Uziel had this power, but he didn't have full control over the power. And therefore, when he was learning Torah, birds were burnt up when they went over him. Those that were greater than him, they could manage it. And therefore, the birds that flew over him weren't affected by the fire. So unlike the Yerushalmi, unlike the view that if you were greater, you'd have a bigger fire, the idea was that these are the people in the middle who still don't have full control over their powers. And yes, they have tremendous powers, and kal v'chomer to the others, but the others could manage the powers. That's part of being mature, part of growing into being a greater person, is knowing how to manage those powers that you have. And so Yonatan ben Uziel was still at that stage where his tremendous powers obviously demonstrated by this, but he wasn't in full control of those powers, and therefore birds that flew over got burnt up. All right, now we move on to the next Mishnah. Omer Zebni Naaman. Person who says, this is my child, he is believed. Omer Zeachi, person says, this is my brother, Eino Naaman. He is not believed. So you can be believed about a child, not about a brother. The Gemara will discuss exactly in what context this is being said. seems obvious from the fact that we're talking about a child and a brother that we're speaking about Yibum. So that a child would negate the necessity for a woman to have Yibum because there's a child. A brother would require there be Yibum because the presence of a brother means that there is somebody to perform Yibum over here. So if the father is believed to say it's his son, the person is not believed to say it's his brother. V'itol imo b'chelko. Now, if someone comes along and says, this is my brother, the other brothers say, we have no idea. We don't know. We never heard of this guy. But he says, I insist, he is our brother. This guy is definitely one of our brothers, and he's entitled to inherit with us. In that case, if the father passes away, and they distribute the inheritance to the brothers, not the new brother, but all the old brothers, then in that case, the old brothers have no obligation to give to this newly found brother that one of the brothers says they found. In that case, they can say, we don't know, or motzi mechaveru l'avaraya, we have no idea, bring proof to the fact that he's a brother and he'll share in the Yerusha. Until then, we're keeping our property. On the other hand, the one brother who declared him definitely a brother has to share his Yerusha with this brother. So in an instance where, the way the Rashbam gives the example, is they have two brothers who are inheriting their father. Each one of them is entitled to 50% of the assets. So if the assets equal 3, they get 1.5 each. If they had a third brother, then they would divide it evenly. They would divide it amongst the three of them. It would be 1, 1, and 1 for each of them. So now you have Reuben and Shimon who are inheriting. Shimon says that Levi is his brother or our brother. And therefore we should be splitting it 3 ways, not 2 ways. Reuben says, I have no idea. I never heard of this guy before. Levi, I don't know who he is. So in that case, what we do is we divide up the assets between Reuben and Shimon and say, Reuben gets 1.5. Shimon gets 1.5. Reuben will say, Amotzi mechaveru olav araya. I have no idea, I'm keeping my 1.5. Shimon, who declares Levi definitely his brother, will have to disgorge 1/2 and give it to Levi, which is his portion of the Yerusha that he would have to give to Levi if he was a brother. So in that case, Levi would end up with 1/2, Shimon would get 1, and Reuven would end up with 1.5. Because Shimon, who declares him a brother, now has to live with his declaration of him being a brother. Mate, if Levi then passes away, Yachzeruni Chasim Limkomam, then the possessions go back to Shimon. Reuven has no entitlement to those possessions of Levi at that point in time, because he didn't give from the Yerusha to Levi. So when you return it to the former state, which is that Shimon will have 1.5, and Reuven will have 1.5. That means whatever Levi has is going to go to Shimon. Nafluni Chasim Limakom Acher. If Levi somehow came into possession of things that didn't come through these brothers, then Yershu Achav Imo. Then all of them inherit it. So not only does Levi inherit it, does Levi, when he gets this extra property and he passes away, not only does Shimon inherit him, but even Reuven will inherit him in that case. So now you have to deal with the inconsistency. If Reuven is not willing to pay in to him as a brother, then he can't also insist that he gets the benefits of him being a brother. So the Rishonim deal with it, the Gemara will deal with it, but just as a big picture, we would have to assume that Shimon would get repaid first. Shimon, who did gave up a part of his Yerusha to Levi, clearly would have to get repaid first for that Yerusha. And then only then would we speak about all the brothers splitting it. Because when Shimon declared him a brother, he declared him a brother for everyone. He didn't declare him a brother just for himself. But you'd also have to address the issue is then how do we work on this? How do we say, Motzi mechaveru olav araya? Then how can Reuven make both claims? I don't own him any Yerusha, but also I will collect all of his Yerusha. So you have to deal with that, and the Gemara will deal with that later. Zebni Neman. Person declares, this person is my son, he's believed. L'may hilchata. What are the halachic ramifications of declaring a son? So the most obvious implication would be for Yerusha, that this child will inherit me. The Gemara says, I'm Rav Yehuda Mishmuel, le'yorsho, to inherit him. V'liftor et ishto min ha'yibum. And also to protect his wife from yibum. Where it says, le'yorsho pshita. When it comes to Yerusha, that is a given. As the Rashbam points out, why is that a given? Because of amigo. The fact is, you could gift the child all your property right now. Since you could gift the child the property, your declaration of the child as your son makes no difference halachically. You're going to give him the property today, if you want. You can say, here's all my property, you have it now. Or, you can have it as be as Yerusha. Why does it make a difference if you declare him your son? Because you can simulate the effect of him being your son by simply gifting all the property today. So it must be that we need in order to say that his wife no longer has to form Yibum because there is a child to the marriage. Well, here the Rashbam discusses, is the Migo really true? Because we discussed this problem with regards to the Bechor. By the Bechor, we said, oh, he can declare him the Bechor, because if he wants to, he can gift him the double portion now. And then later on, what's the difference if he calls him a Bechor now or if he calls him a Bechor later? He'll gift him the property now or give it to him as Yerusha. So of course he can declare him as the Bechor because he can make whatever difference it is today. The answer that the Gemara gave was there's a difference between what happens to the property that comes afterwards in the assets of the father. The father can only gift assets or property that exists today. What he can't gift is property in the future. He can't get property that will come to him later on. And the Gemara goes through different scenarios until he gets to being a goses. Even if he's on his deathbed where he can't make the gifting, does it still work? So the Gemara discussed over there that in that case, he has the right because of the pasuk of Yakir to declare him the Bechor and declare him the Bechor to the point where it has implications not only during his lifetime, but even after his death. What the Rashbam points out over here is we don't have a similar pasuk by the child. And therefore that difference will exist, which is the father can only declare him a child for Yusha with regards to assets that exist in the estate currently. Anything that is acquired into the estate after that point in time will not be governed by this nemanut of calling him his child. That's number one. Number two is it says if he's a goses, if he's on his deathbed and he can't be kinyanim anymore, then he can't do this. Or he can't add property to the child. There's a difference between the Bechor and the child over here. By the Bechor, we know the Bechor is a child. It's not a question. Just a question, does he get the double portion? So over there, even as a goses, he can make that declaration where he could give him the property. Over here, he's declaring him a child. He has to do a full-fledged kinyan to give it to him because that child changes him from being outside the world of the Yerusha to inside the world of the Yerusha. And that's a big difference between him being not a child and being a child versus being a child and a Bechor or being a child with not being a Bechor. For that reason, the Rashbam actually says here that there is a difference between a Bechor and this child in terms of the Nemanut and up to which point the father has Nemanut to give the child the Yerusha. And the Baal HaTosafot also say a similar thing, which is a Nechasim Shadav Lo Chashu Goseis Lo Yeneman. He would not be believed about property that falls to him as a goses, because over there he doesn't have the capacity, doesn't have the migo to grant him the property, and that's what the Rashbam says similarly. So over here, for the Rashbam and the Baal HaTosafot, then Ben, you have believability to make him into your son for Yerusha up to a point. But beyond that point, you won't have believability or you won't be able to be Morishim, different than a Bechor. There are other Rishonim that disagree and say that the Yakir that grants the father the right to declare the Bechor, also gives the father the right to declare a child. And therefore, you can declare the child a child, and it'll work through and through all the assets of the Yerusha, because the Pasuk of Yakir applies not only to a Bechor, but even to a regular child. But that machloket, it's a big machloket, is whether the believability of Ne'aman by a child, until what point does that work? According to the Rashbam, it works until the point that you can no longer gift the property, because at that point you lose your Migo, and therefore the Ne'amanut goes away. On the other hand, for those Rishonim who think it comes from Yakir, it works all the way through to the death of the individual for all the assets of the estate. Right now, the Gemara said that the real nafkamina about having a child is whether the wife has to perform Yibum or not. Until now, we didn't know he had children. He declares this child his child. That means that his wife doesn't have to have Yibum anymore. So that's what the Gemara says. That's what the halach of Zeh B'ni Ne'aman is. Gemara says, Hanami Tanina. That's an explicit Mishnah. Mishamar b'shat mitato, someone is on his deathbed, yeshli banim, I have children, ne'aman, he is believed. Yeshli achim, I have brothers, enu ne'aman, he's not believed. So Gemara says, wait, you have a Mishnah that already says it. What do we need our Mishnah over here if you have another Mishnah that tells us in Kiddushin exactly this information? Gemara says, there's a difference. Hatam dom lo muksog lan ba'ach. Hacha afagam dom muksog le ba'ach. The difference has to do with the chazoka that exists at that time. The chazoka is something that he was going to try to override. For instance, the fact that we know he has brothers. If we know he has brothers, then the wife is expected to perform Yibum or Chalitza with those brothers, because that's information we have. What he doesn't have the capacity to do is to undermine that, to come along and say that I don't have any brothers, or the brothers don't exist anymore. Because in that way, he'd be undermining a chazokah that we knew that there were brothers. What he is Ne'aman to do is that if he says, Zeh B'ni Ne'aman, this is my child, he is Ne'aman, then what we're saying now is the fact that there are two Mishnayot come to teach you that not only when we had no brothers there before, and therefore the woman wasn't assumed to have to do Yibum. Why? Because we didn't know he had any brothers. We didn't know he had any children. But the lack of brothers makes there's no Yibum, so the lack of children is not meaningful. In that case, if he says, this is my child, okay, he didn't change the status quo. On the other hand, in our situation, this is the Chiddush of our Mishnah, is even if we know he has brothers, that means that the Chazakah was that she should perform Yibum. If he comes along and says, Zebni, this is my child, Neman, he is believed in that case to undermine the Chazakah that she would have to perform Yibum. And that's the Chiddush of our Mishnah. Our Mishnah is coming to teach you that the Nemanut of the father to declare the child is not only in the case of the absence of a Chazakah, where you can say, this is my child, because he doesn't upend or change the status quo, but even in a case where he comes to change the status quo, he's believed to say, this is my child, and to say now that the woman is not Chayevet in Yibum. What he can't say, number one, is, I have brothers, because that would change the status quo from the woman being Peturah from Yibum, now all of a sudden to being Chayevet in Yibum. He doesn't have a right to declare he has brothers and then make her Chayevet in Yibum, because the status quo, the Chazakah until this point was, she's not Chayevet in Yibum. And similarly, he can't say, I have no brothers. If we thought there were brothers, and we know there were brothers, so she was Chayevet in Yibum, he can't come along and declare, I have no brothers, and make her Peturah from Yibum. So by brothers, you cannot upend the status quo or the Chazakah that exists. But by the child, you are empowered, because of the duplication of the Mishnah, to teach you that you are empowered to even upend a Chazakah. Over here, the Rashbam, like he said earlier, says with regards to Nemanut, he only has Nemanut against a Chazakah. That means that he's Neman to say, this is my child, against a Chazakah where we didn't think he had children. On the other hand, he does not have Nemanut against Edim. There are Edim here that said that he doesn't have children. And he comes along and says, I have a child, Zebni. According to the Rashbam, Enu Neman, because it's the equivalent of a Mali the Shaker by Malcolm Edim. There's no reason for him to lie in the face of Edim. We don't say that. Mali the Shaker is a principle that we say, what's the point of him lying? There's no reason for him to lie. Well, over here, there is a point for him to lie, because if he says that as a child, then his wife is Peturah from Yibum. We'll see in a second why he's Neman then. Why is he Neman if he's trying to change the status quo? She was Chayevet in Yibum. If he says as a child, she's Peturah in Yibum. So we'll see in a second why he has Nemanut. But what the Rashbam says is that Nemanut only extends to against the Chazakah. If we have Edim that he didn't have children, and then he comes and says, oh, this is my child, there he cannot override Edim. Like we saw back there, there are other Rishonim believe that he can even overcome Edim with this Nemanut. Amar of Yosef, Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Mipnei Ma'amru, Zebni Neman. Why is he believed? Now, by Yusha, we explained why he's believed, because he has a Migo. He could have gifted the property to the child. So the fact that he says he's a child for Yerusha, Mali the Shaker, or Migo, since you could do whatever you want now, makes no difference if it happens later, so that's why he's believed. But by the case of Yibum, he says this is a child, she's now Peturah mi Yibum. What could he do today that would change the status quo? Hoel ubal shamar girashti et ishti ne'eman. Since a husband who says that I divorced my wife is believed, that's why he's believed over here. So the truth is, we're going to amend this in the Gemara now, but the concept still will exist, whatever is being said here. I'm Rav Yosef, married Avram, master of Avram, and he's like, by God, oh my gosh, how could you say this? Talitanya, but below Tanya. You're putting something that's in a Mishnah and trying to explain it with something that's not in a Mishnah. Or, in essence, we know that B'neo Ne'aman, and now the reason you're giving it for it is some reason that has nothing to do with this case. You're saying, oh, a husband is believed to say that he divorced his wife. What relevance then does that have to us over here? You're saying, oh, that's the reason here, and that reason has nothing to do with our case at all. So you're taking something that's a different case, and now trying to apply it to here, to a Mishnah. Ela, i'itmar hachi'itmar. This is the way it needs to be said. The Rashbam claims that Rabbi Yosef, going through this iteration, through the learning over here, is because Rabbi Yosef, as you know, fell ill in the middle of his life and forgot much of what he had learned. So therefore, he forgot what he had heard over from Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, from Yehuda's Rebbe. And now when he remembers it, he says it doesn't make sense. So he's trying to amend it to make sense of what his Rebbe had said. And that's what he's doing over here. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Minei Ma'amru Zeh B'ni Ne'aman. Why is a person who declares a child believed? Ho B'yadol Gasha, because he can divorce his wife now. You could accomplish the same thing you want to accomplish by declaring this child your child, by divorcing your wife. The reason to declare this child your child is so that your wife doesn't have to perform Yibum, after your death. So here he's on his deathbed, and he doesn't want his wife to have to do Yibum. She says, this is my child. He could accomplish the same thing and prevent her from having to perform Yibum by divorcing her. So since he could divorce her and simulate the effect of avoiding Yibum, so when he says, this is my child, we believe him, because Malo L'Shaker. There's no reason for him to lie. He could create the same outcome without having to lie. So in that case, we believe him. So again here, as we said before, the Rashbam says that he's only believed against the Chazakah. He's not believed against Edim in this case. Now, this Mali L'Shaker, or this Migo, has a flaw in it. And that the Balei Tosafot point out, which is that if he divorces her, the woman will no longer be able to marry a Kohen afterwards. So how can you say that it's Malo L'Shaker or Amigo? If he says he has a child, then the woman, after his passing, can marry whoever she wants. She can marry a Kohen, she can marry anybody out there. On the other hand, if he says that it was through a divorce, then his wife will be precluded from marrying a Kohen after the fact. So Tosfot says, how could he be believed with regards to this? So Tosfot says that's a sufficient Migo. The Migo is simply that since he can simulate the effect of not needing Yibum through Gerushin, therefore he's believed, even though if he had done Gerushin, she'd be Pasula, the Kohuna. Nevertheless, he's believed. That's enough of a Migo. It's sufficient enough. The logic behind it might be, which is, he is looking out for the best interest of his wife. With regards to Yibum, he doesn't have to perform Yibum. Does he really care whether she can marry a Kohen or not marry a Kohen after his death? He looks out for her best interest in terms of Yibum. But in terms of who she marries afterwards, that he's not going to concern himself with. And therefore, the Migo is a fine Migo because he'd be willing to divorce her to protect her from the Yibum. And therefore, when he says Zebani, he's Neman because it's not a deficit in the Migo. That's the way the Balei Tosafot learn it. Others suggest that the Migo is only sufficient to allow her to marry non-Kohanim. She wants to marry a Kohen, Zebani would not be Neman. That's not enough because the Migo would not allow her to marry a Kohen. And therefore, the Migo that makes him believable by Zebani, Neman, only works for non-Kohanim. It doesn't work for Kohanim. Others, like the Ramban, speculate that it would be sufficient, even though the Migo is only good for non-Kohanim, once we already believe him because of that Migo, then it also works for Kohanim. So they speculate, and others after the Ramban say it definitively, that yes, he is believed by a Kohen, because since the Migo works and he's believed with regards to other parties, we throw in the Kohen afterwards. The Tosafot says something along those lines without getting there, but just saying that the Migo is sufficient enough for making him believable. Once he's believed, then we don't look in whether yes Kohen, no Kohen in that case. All right. Amar Rav Yosef. Hashkada Amart Amrinin Hoil. Now that we say, based on the Mishnah, Hoil, which is, since he could divorce her to protect against Yibum, therefore he's believed that this boy is his child to prevent her from having to form Yibum. Baal Shamar Grashti Et Ishti Neman. A husband who says he divorced his wife is believed. Hobi Odel LeGarsha. Because he could divorce her right now. If he says, I divorced my wife, we say, how do we know? He said, well, listen, he should be believed because if he wants to, he could just divorce her on the spot. The fact that he's saying that he divorced her before should give him believability because he can simulate the effect of the divorce by simply divorcing her now. Kiata Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef Amar Rabbi Yochanan. So now we have a dissenting opinion to this conclusion of Rabbi Yosef that is brought by Rabbi Yochanan. Baal Shamar Grashya Tishri Einu Ne'aman. Husband who says I divorced my wife is not believed. So Rabbi Yosef said he is believed because he could divorce her now. Rabbi Yochanan says he's not believed. Now Peach Rav Sheshe Biyodeh. Rav Sheshet either waved his hands, or he blew his hands, the way that the Rashbam says it, like you blow straw that flies away. He was indicating, he was making like some sort of gesture that indicated that there was a problem here. Azalei Hoil de Rav Yosef. Now we just lost the Hoil of Rav Yosef. Based on what Rav Yochanan says that the Baal's not Neman, the Hoil of Rav Yosef now falls apart. Since he could divorce her now, he's believed to say that he divorced her beforehand. We just lost that based on Rav Yochanan saying that they're not Neman. Now, as the Balei Tosafot point out over here, that's only true by the woman. And the Rashbam makes a similar point over here, and that is because Kala Itla, divorce is something that has public nature to it, and it gets out there. It's a rumor that you would have known. And that means that if he says, I divorced my wife, we should have had evidence of that through the rumor mill or through the public at large knowing about the divorce. It's the type of thing that's not kept secretive, something that comes into the public domain. And we say that in general. Anytime a shtar is involved, it goes into public knowledge. Because Edim, Sofer, all these things make it that it's going to go into the public domain. That's why when you have a milveh b'shtar, the buyers are not protected because we say you should have known about it. Something that's in the public domain. Milveh al peh, you can't come after the kuchot because there's no way they could have known about it. The fact that we don't have that information already downgrades your believability. Because now you're trying to what we call be a migo b'makom edim, as the Rashbam says. You have edim in the sense that edim would be that there'd be a kol. There'd be some sort of public knowledge about the divorce. The lack of public knowledge makes it as if that there should not be a divorce here. And if you go ahead and now declare a divorce, you're going up against edim and you're not going to be believed. Or the way that others say it is that the woman's living in his house right now. And he comes along and says, I divorced her before. Well, they're living like husband and wife, and he's saying that I divorced her before, why should he be believed? So that's the other possibility. That's not true by a child, as the Balei Tosafot point out. By a child, person can have a child that nobody knows about. That's what you were discussing before. People can have children, who knows where, and nobody has any idea that they have this child, that this child exists. Therefore, the holy of Rav Yosef will still stand with regards to a child. You will be believed to declare a child, even though we've never heard of this child before, never knew about it before. You will be believed because of the migo that you could divorce the woman to simulate the effect of not eating yibum. So therefore you're believed to say this is a child to do that. But to be believed that you divorced your wife previously, that you won't be believed because you have chazokot or edim in a sense going against you. The fact that there's no public knowledge about it, or the fact that you're living together with this woman are indications that you didn't divorce her. And therefore you're not believed according to Rabbi Yochanan, and that's why we lost this oil of Rabbi Yosef, and that's what Rabbi Sheshet was, in a sense, bemoaning. Ini, is that really true? Bama Rabbi Chia by Avin Amar Rabbi Yochanan. So again, Rabbi Yochanan's in Eretz Yisrael. And over here you have people bringing Memrod from Rabbi Yochanan to Bavel. You have many times in Shas this phenomenon. And here we have them bringing two different Memrod from Rabbi Yochanan. The first one that says that Enu Ne'aman. And the second one saying, Baal Shamar Girashtet Ishti Ne'aman. That a husband who says, I divorced my wife, is believed, similar to Rabbi Yosef. So you have a stira in the Mesorah from Rabbi Yochanan as to whether the Baal is believed when he says, I divorced my wife. Lo kasha. Gemara says, no problem. Kan l'mafreya, kan l'haba. Depends if you're saying this prospectively or you're saying it retroactively. The way that the Rashbam says it is, he's saying that we got divorced on a date that was a month ago. So over there, Rabbi Yochanan says he's not believed, because the migo doesn't help you. The migo that you can divorce her today doesn't mean that you could divorce her back a month ago. The impact of that is, when did the divorce happen? So he doesn't have a right to declare her divorced previously, if he can only now divorce her, and that's the migo. The migo says, I can divorce you now, therefore I must have divorced you before. No, if I divorced you now, that means you can be divorced heretofore, but you can't retroactively be divorced. And the nafkamina is, if Edim show up and say that she had an extramarital affair between the time that we're standing now and the time that he claims that he divorced her. In that case, we're not going to believe her that she was divorced, because he doesn't have nemanut to declare retroactively that she was divorced. Because the whole migo works in the effect of saying, since you could divorce her today, you're believed that she's divorced. That only is prospectively, that is not retroactively, and that's what mikana la'aba means. So the Rashbam says, if you use language that implies that it was retroactive, you're not believed. If you use language that says that now or stam, you give language that doesn't indicate when the divorce happened, you will be believed, mikana laba. Heretofore, you will believe that she is divorced because you could have handed a divorce to her right now. So why lie about her being divorced if you could hand her a divorce anyway? So then the Gemara is going to continue to ask about this. That's the view of what the Mafreya and the Mikana Laba is for the Rashbam. We'll continue to read the Gemara like the Rashbam, and then we'll come back and see the Rabbeinu Gershom has a different version of the Gemara. Yibailu, Amayla Mafreya, if he said it retroactively, Maulem Nune Laba, can you believe him prospectively? So he declares that we were divorced a month ago. So now we say he's not believed, because what right does he have to declare them divorced a month ago? He doesn't have a migo to make him Ne'aman. His migo only says that today he could divorce her, so therefore he should believe from today forward. But the fact that he declared her divorced retroactively, did that undermine his claim? And now we say that she is not divorced, period. That means not earlier and not prospectively. Or do we say that even prospectively, she is divorced? Mi pagina dibura o lo pagina dibura. Do we bifurcate his statement or do we not bifurcate his statement? Rav Mari v'Rav Zvid, Rav Machloket Amorayim with regard to this. Chadamar Poginan, One says that we divide his statement up. We say the fact that he said, I am divorced, that we believe. The fact he said, I am divorced 30 days ago, that we don't believe. So we break his statement down into two parts and say, the fact that he stated he's divorced, that we believe. The fact that he stated he was divorced a month ago, that part we do not believe. And we say only prospectively is believed to be divorced. And one says that these are inseparable statements. He's saying, I'm divorced a month ago. You can't say, oh, it means I'm divorced. And the month ago we dropped. It means that I was divorced a month ago. He's not believed. He's not believed about that. He's not believed prospectively either. And therefore, it would not be Neman to say that she is divorced. It says, Maishna de Rova. How did this case differ from the case in Sanhedrin that Rova speaks about Pagina and Dibura, which is Doma Rova, Ish Ploni Ba'al Ishti. Person comes to court and testifies that this man had an extramarital affair with his wife. Who? Vacher? If he testifies. And a third party shows up and also testifies to the fact that this man had an affair with this individual's wife. Mitzkarfim Lahor Go. They are able to join together to kill the perpetrator of this extramarital affair, or go below the horga. He has the right to have the man killed, but not his wife killed. Because there we say, palgina dibura. We split his statement. His statement is that this individual had an extramarital affair with my wife. As far as wife is concerned, his testimony is invalid, because his wife is considered to be a karov. And since she is a karov, you can't testify about her. So now, if he testifies about both of them together, we would have thought that his testimony is invalid. What Rava comes along, or the Chiddush of Rava is, no, Pagin and Debura. We bifurcate his statement and say he made two statements. One statement is that this man had an extramarital affair. Another statement is his wife had an extramarital affair. With regards to his wife, we drop that testimony, we don't believe him. With regards to the man, we believe him. And therefore, if another aide shows up and also testifies to that effect, we say that they are mitzareif, and they can put this person to death, even though his testimony involved both this individual and his wife. You say Pagin and Dibura. What the Gemara wants to know is, why by Rova do you say Pagin and Dibura, and over here, you don't say Pagin and Dibura? Why is it different? The Gemara answers, Betrei Gufe Paginan, Betachat Gufa Lo Paginan. When it comes to two separate entities, we'll be Pagin and Dibura. When it's a single entity, we won't be Pagin and Dibura. In the case in Sanhedrin, you have the extramarital affair, which is perpetrated by the man and his wife. So we'll bifurcate his statement and say the statement about his wife will drop, and the statement about the other individual we will keep, because they're two separate parties. Over here, when he testifies about his wife and says, I am divorced from her, then when he says, I am divorced retroactively, you can't bifurcate the statement because it's all about the same woman. You're saying, oh, I'm divorced retroactively, that we don't believe. I'm divorced from today, we do believe. So you're trying to split or bifurcate a statement about the same person, that doesn't work. You can bifurcate it when it's about two people, you can't bifurcate it when it's about one individual. The Bali and Tosafot over here say, what is the Chiddush over here that you're not believed, the Mafreya, you're not believed retroactively to say you're divorced? He says, if you're believed to say that you're divorced retroactively, then why ever date a get? You never have to put a date into a get. The Gemara told us in Gittin, the reason that you put a date in a get is because we want to prevent people from protecting their spouses in extramarital affairs or in situations where they're mizanet. So the case that the Gemara brings is a case where he's married to his niece. When he's married to his niece went ahead and was mizana, and she had an extramarital affair. She's going to be put to death for that. So here, her husband, who's her uncle, he might not be happy about what happened, he might want to divorce her, but he doesn't want her to have to be put to death, his niece. So what he does is he backdates the divorce, so that it was before the time of his note. And in doing so, he protects her from having an extramarital affair, because she was already divorced. So the Gemara says you must put a date in the get in order to prevent that type of situation of backdating. So now Tosfot says, if that's the case, then of course he can't be believed Nem Remafreya. If he's believed Mafreya, then you undermine the whole Takanat Chazal of dating in a get. Because then the date doesn't matter if you can say to him, oh, I divorced retroactively, no get, oh yeah, we lost the get, but I divorced her before. If he was believed, then putting a date in a get would have no bearing or no effectiveness, because you can always just declare it beforehand. So Tosfot says it's Pshita that you can't be believed retroactively. The question here is, Mikano da Abba. So he says, according to the one who says, Lo Palginan Dibura, that's the Chiddush. The chiddush over here is not only you're not believed retroactively, you're also not believed prospectively. That's the chiddush of the Gemara. He says, what I don't understand is according to one who says, Pagin and Dibura, that we split it, what's the chiddush here? The chiddush that he's not believed, Lamafreya, that's obvious. That he is believed, Mekana Laba, that's Pagin and Dibura. So then what is the Enu Ne'aman of Rabbi Yochanan? What's the chiddush of Enu Ne'aman? And Tosu leaves that as a Tzarechion. Says, according to what it says, Bagin and Dibura, I'm not sure what the Kiddush is that you're not believed retroactively. Of course you're not believed retroactively. There's no reason to think you should be, because otherwise you undermine other Takanot Chazal. In the end, the Tosfot says, about Rava's statement in Sanhedrin about Bagin and Dibura, what was the Havamina? So the Havamina of the Gemara that you should be believed here is the fact that a person is Karov Itzel Atzmo. A person is a Karov to himself, but maybe he's not a Karov to his Ishto. He's not considered to be a karov with regards to his wife, and therefore he should be believed about both testimonies. So the Rabbeinu Chaim says about that, that is ludicrous. To think that a person is not a karov to his wife doesn't make any sense. We say many places in Shas, Ishto, Kigufo. And we look at a person as being a karov to his wife in all the places throughout Shas. And given that, there's no reason to have a havamina that he should not be considered a karov. But rather, the havamina was this. The Havamina is that he should be believed both by this individual and his wife through a Migo. Migo that we believe in with the third party that had the extramarital affair with his wife, then we also believe in with regards to his wife. And that would have been the Havamina. Rova's Chiddush is Pagina Dibura. We believe in with the third party, we do not believe in with regards to his wife. And that's the Chiddush of Rova, to teach you that, yes, of course he's a Karov to Ishto, but even though he's a Karov to Ishto, we might have thought we would believe him since we believe him with the other guy, and we're putting the other guy to death because of that, he should be believed about his wife. Rava says, no, Pagin and Dibura, and we keep the testimony separate. Believed about the third party, he's not believed about his wife. That's the way that the Rashbam reads the Gemara. On the other hand, you can see in the Rabbeinu Gershom, there's an alternate view about what the Mafreya and Mikano Labai is. He says the following, Dehachi Perusha, Im Zinta Ishto, his wife had an extramarital affair, Botar Hachi Gamar Kirishtia, after the fact, he says, I divorced her, called him Shazinta, before she had the extramarital affair, because they depotra mimita, because that would then exonerate her from having a death penalty. Ein Ne'aman, he's not believed. De'ika lameimar mechape alea, because you could say he's covering up for her, and therefore he's not believed. So if he comes to testify that I was divorced after this nut happened, that's called a mafreya. She already had an extramarital affair, and after the fact he comes and says, we were really divorced beforehand, there he's not believed. As opposed to the Rashbam's case, the Mashkam's case, he simply said that we were divorced earlier. There was no incident. Adin came later and testified that she had an extramarital affair. But at the time that he said it, we didn't have that information. That's what he called him a freya, simply as he says the date was before today. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom learns it is not that we have information, and he's trying to declare a divorce after we have the information that she had an extramarital affair. Mikana Laba is a case where he tells us we are divorced, and then prospectively she has a znut, she has an affair. So in that case, he is believed because when he gave us the information, that we had no information about the extramarital affair because it happened in the future. Since it happened in the future, he's believed to say that she was divorced at that time because he declared it at a time that he was not Nogea but Davar in terms of covering up for her, because the incident had yet to take place. So that's the nature of the Mafreya and the Kana Laba. And then the question comes up in a case where he comes before us, she's already Zinta. She already had an extramarital affair. He comes along and says, we were divorced before the extramarital affair. So now the question is, do we believe him prospectively? Retroactively, he's clearly not believed, because he's Nogea but Davar, because he's trying to cover up for her. But now, prospectively, she has another extramarital affair. Is he believed now because he said she was divorced? When he declared the divorce, it was retroactively, and it was in the face or in light of an extramarital affair that already happened. But now, is he believed prospectively to say things that happen in the future will not be problematic? Why does it make a difference? She's already subject to the death penalty for the first note. What happens is, what happens if the edim that came to testify about the first case or made into Edim Zomunim, or they die and we lose the testimony, and you no longer have Edim to the first case. So now, if you have an Edim to the second case, which was after he had declared divorce, retroactively, is he believed? Do we view him as being colored by his trying to protect her retroactively, and therefore we don't believe him prospectively? Or do we say that the two cases are independent? Yes, we don't believe him about the previous extramarital affair to say he was divorced before it, but prospectively, where he has no interest or knowledge of it, then we believe him to say that he's divorced going forward. And then the Gemara brings that as an argument of Palgin Dibura, that we split his statement. That we say that, yes, he's divorced prospectively, but not retroactively, and that depends on the Palgin Dibura of Rova and the difference between the cases as to whether it's one goof or two goof, as to whether we do or don't say Palgin Dibura over here. Okay, we're going to stop here at the bottom of Kuf Lamed Daled Amud Bet.